Oh, lots of people wanted to weigh in on the Ukraine. What? They elected a comedian to be president? Someone said Donald Trump, clown. Somebody else says drama teacher Trudeau. It's just too easy. The jokes write themselves. There's no challenge at all. What we need is more politicians. More politicians. Actually, Ross Haynes is going to talk to us about that coming up. We're also going to speak with Jeffrey Hossick, a licensed psychotherapist, a little bit about the work he's been doing. Dave Gunning, factivist, had some pictures taken with Ellen Page. She was here in Nova Scotia recently. Kind of a surprise visit by Ms. Page. In our studio this afternoon, the director of Sierra Club Canada here in the Atlantic region, Gretchen Fitzgerald. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day.
When we think of April 22nd, how long has Earth Day been around? How long have we been recognizing Earth Day?
Well, the idea of it sort of started around 1969, 1970. So, you know, 1970 in the United States anyway is when the first sort of teach-ins happened. And it's interesting in the context of what we're looking at in Atlantic Canada in terms of oil drilling, because a lot of the response came in response to a massive oil spill off of California. And in, you know, the next couple of years, some of the folks that were tasked with cleaning up that spill and dealing with it, you know, just said, you know what, stuff's happening with regard to how we treat the earth, and we have to start, you know, doing more to raise consciousness and also to celebrate, you know, the vibrancy, the vibrant living planet that we all rely on. So
it's a message that is resonating clearly. And then again, there are people still who say, no, this isn't a real thing, that man-made or man-influenced climate change isn't the real deal. It's not the real thing.
Yeah, and those are fewer in number now. I mean, I do think, you know, we're seeing in New Brunswick the last 2 days reports of flooding happening again. And, you know, the Army's coming in and helping folks with sandbags and the Red Cross as well. I think, you know, telling someone who's had their place flooded for, you know, 2 or 3 years in a row that this isn't real, you know, I think it's you're starting to look more and more like you have, you know, you're being influenced by the oil industry. You're not being influenced by the facts. So I think that dialogue is becoming, or you know, a smaller portion of the conversation, and now we're more focused on solutions. But it's still out there, and I think a lot of it is just coming from those who have vested interests in sticking with fossil fuels.
We've got Gretchen Fitzgerald here, Sierra Club Canada. What's the focus? What's the mandate? What's the mission statement?
Well, we have a threefold one, and the first one, you know, is to enjoy a healthy, safe planet. So getting folks outside. One of the cool things we do here in Atlantic Canada through our Wild Child program is get kids outside exploring, enjoying nature on their own terms. And if you want to be, if you're feeling down the dumps, or you're feeling like we need to, reset the clock, this is one way to do it, is get your kids outside enjoying. And then the other two parts of our mandate is protecting and restoring the planet. So tackling things like climate change, stopping oil and gas drilling off our coast, making sure wildlife is protected. We have a great program here called Watch for Wildlife, which is reducing the impact of our roadways on wildlife populations. So protecting and restoring those ecosystems, which we all rely on. And I guess the other thing that's cool about Sierra Club, and I think what's really needed now because of the way people are feeling and seeing in terms of changes in the environment, whether it's loss of wildlife or climate change, is a grassroots mandate. So people taking action based on their own experience and their own solutions in their community. So we have a grassroots movement mandate.
I know Earth Hour has become an event, and it wanes and it grows and it becomes, you know, perhaps less important, more important year over year. Was there anything planned specifically for Earth Day today? Did you guys have any plans?
Actually, across the country, our different chapters did have events planned. So on Prince Edward Island, we're having a cool Earth Day celebration at the Farm Center. Our Quebec chapter is also having a gathering of experts to talk about different environmental issues. So there's different events happening, and I'm sure there's other folks doing cleanups and other things today. But I guess one of the biggest things we had planned for this week is a rally to protect our environmental laws in Halifax on Wednesday, the 24th.
That's happening because there's a committee, a Senate committee that happens to be in Halifax. I was wondering about the timing. It's Wednesday of this week. Sierra Club, along with Ecology Action Center, will be there. Yeah. So you say rally for strong environmental laws. This has to do with Bill C-69.
Yeah.
What do you know about what Bill C-69 is intended to do?
Well, the intent of it was to meet the our democratically elected government's promise to make our environmental assessment laws credible again. And I think before the last federal election, people felt that how we were assessing projects like pipelines had lost a lot of its credibility because of a conflict of interest position of regulators like the National Energy Board that was assessing pipelines. And on the East Coast, the role of offshore petroleum boards who are, you know, in have mandates, dual mandates to promote and ostensibly to regulate the industry as well. So the idea behind the bill was to make assessments for projects like pipelines, for offshore drilling, other larger projects more credible again. Unfortunately, over the process of expert panels and consultations with Canadians, there were very strong recommendations to make this bill very strong. It has already been weakened, but unfortunately the Senate now is being pressured by oil interests to weaken it even further. And of great concern to us on the East Coast is the fact that our offshore petroleum boards are going to get greater power under this bill, which is going exactly 180 degrees the opposite direction from what our federal government promised us.
Now, because it's Bill C-69, this was a piece of legislation government introduced, mm-hmm. it's now at the Senate level. The Senate mm-hmm. can outright reject it. They can now offer suggestions for changes. Mm-hmm. But we have what they describe now as an independent Senate. It doesn't vote as a group per se. So are there specific senators you're trying to get the attention of? Are there specific people that you're concerned that they may be perhaps leaning one way or another based on their past history?
Well, we are concerned that there is still a block of senators that are identify as conservatives. So they are being pressured, it sounds like, to think that this bill, which is about better planning for projects and making sure that any project that does get approved is actually in line with what communities want and is in line with their sustainable development goals and will help us meet our climate targets. I mean, these are all, you would think, good objectives of any senior elder statesperson that would want to happen. Unfortunately, they're being heavily pressured to think that this is somehow a destructive bill. And like I say, it's already been weakened in its current draft. So to think that they don't understand that this is the least that Canada can do given the climate crisis that we're facing and the other crisis of wildlife protection as well that we're facing, it's really unfortunate. So it seems like they are being pressured, but the cool thing is, you know, they are traveling to regions. They are hopefully going to hear from Canadians. We are hoping at the rally on Wednesday, they will hear from folks who have actually in Nova Scotia been looking for greater role of federal assessment. Things like the No Pipe, you know, activists, people who want a greater federal assessment of what's happening with Northern Pulp. Folks who are looking at the Alton Gas issue, you know, the dumping of salt into a river that's on, you know, traditional unceded territory. Things like this would be tackled better if we had more valid assessment processes. So we're hoping folks will come out and say to the senators of all stripes, greater environmental assessment is actually in the interests of all Canadians, and to stop listening to corporate interests.
Again, our guest is Gretchen Fitzgerald. She is the director of the Sierra Club of Canada here in the Nova Scotia region. When we talk about this rally, I suspect placards, there will be people there to send along their message. Are you actually making an appearance at the Senate committee?
Yes, I'm very fortunate I'll be there and have been asked to be a witness. And also Lisa Mitchell of East Coast Environmental Law will be there and Mark Butler of Ecology Action Center. And, we will have an opportunity to convey our concerns to the senators about the possibility that, like I say, the offshore boards would get greater power under the current draft of the bill. And we hope we will be heard. And, you know, I am also hoping that the senators will look out their windows and see this, you know, a swath of society that actually supports greater protection, that understands we're in a climate crisis, that understands we need to do better with regard to protecting the environment.
There's a young lady, another Gretchen, who's been in the news a lot.
Oh, Greta.
Greta.
I know.
And a lot of people are saying, here's a young person. Mm. We know about Stella Bowles up in the Lehave River area. And so there are young people who are trying to stand up and have their voices heard.
Yep. And it's amazing. I mean, I, you know, will it confess to being in tears sometimes watching Greta speak, because it is so inspiring to have a young person who is obviously feeling the climate crisis to her very soul, but also is taking action. And I think what's important on Earth Day is to remember these are challenges, but these are also opportunities. Mm. And she is just carrying that torch for all of us and is such a great spokesperson for the earth, because everything she says is about taking action. It's a crisis, but you know, if your house is on fire, then you take action and you help your neighbors take action. And I think of her when I look at the Army helping people sandbagging. Taking action on climate is actually part of our obligation, but it also can be a very heroic thing. And I hope that our leaders, we're going into a federal election in the fall, will start taking up that torch as well and not just leaving it to the children.
Gretchen Fitzgerald, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, and happy Earth Day to
you all. Happy Earth Day to you, too. We'll take a break. Dave Gutting's our guest right after this.
Is this time of peace reach the end? There's a storm on the ocean closing in. We want a safe harbor, we want a clean shore, but you think it was the whole wide world we were asking for.
This is Dave Gutting from his newest recording, and when he was last with us on the broadcast, someone asked, hey, did you ever write about the pulp mill? That song is about the pulp mill, if I'm not mistaken. Dave Gutting, back with us on the show. How are you, sir?
Hey, Sheldon. How you doing?
Very well. Very well. That song that we were just listening to, where'd that come from?
My brother and I were chatting one time, you know, reading documents about the mill and stuff, and just kind of wishing we were wrong about everything. it's like, wow, I never want to be more wrong about anything in my life, you know, and we were just, you know, hoping that some expert would set us down and say, you know what, guys, they're really not poisoning the community. Everything's fine. They're great. They're fantastic. And there's nothing to worry about. But unfortunately, no one's been able to do that. So it was just kind of the sentiment of wish I was wrong.
Wish I was wrong. Dave Gutting. Dave, you've been a factivist. You've been a factivist not quite as long as you've been a singer-songwriter, and clearly those two issues came together with that tune. And, you know, there's been much said, and in fact, we had you on the show asking, what can an Ellen Page bring to this conversation? Well, how about Ellen Page came to be here in Nova Scotia? This was last week. How did that come about?
I guess on her own, she's been reading about the issue and other things that in the province that she's concerned about, and you know, she spends a lot of time here. She's a Nova Scotian, and I guess just passionate about bringing some of these issues that she's concerned about to light. You know, she's definitely she's genuine, and she's informed and becoming more and more informed all the time. But I was really impressed with her. She was very knowledgeable, and she seems like a real solid person. And yeah, it's just nothing, no pretense. she's being really honest, you know, and good on her.
Dave Gutting is here with us, and it was last week that Ellen Page and her crew came here to Nova Scotia. Do you know what was behind that? Is this going to be broadcast somewhere? Is this for a documentary? Any idea? Any sense?
I'm not sure. She did have a camera guy, and she had a couple of people helping her out. It appears that they are shooting a documentary, and so they did. They interviewed a whole bunch of people. That day that I was with her, I was interviewed by her, and so was Joan Baxter. So I think that their plan is to put something together fairly quickly, and I'd be curious to see it.
Hmm. Dave Gutting is here with us on the broadcast. And, you know, a lot has been said about the future of the mill in the community. And can we separate the two issues? I know that the Northern Pulp, that the Boat Harbor Treatment Facility is one that's kind of at the center. It's part of the reason behind this deadline that's coming up, and that the mill owners have said, you know what, if we don't get an extension, there won't be a mill to worry about. How does that make Dave Gutting feel about what he's been working towards?
Well, I don't understand it. I mean, Asia Pulp and Paper are one of the largest pulp and paper companies in the world. They own pulp mills all over the world. They clearly know what they're doing. They own eight pulp mills under Paper Excellence Canada in Canada, I think. And I think it's 8. The Port Hawkesbury pulp mill, the entire mill, the PM2 plant, was built in a year. Yet these guys can't figure out how to build a treatment system for an existing mill within 5 years. So it just doesn't add up to me. Like, I still am of the mind that they're just kind of faking it, and they don't want anyone to know they're closing yet, because if their suppliers and the union and all these people think that they're closing, then they're not going to be fighting for them, right? So it's, but I don't know. It just, something doesn't add up to me. If the entire Port Hawkesbury pulp mill can be built in a year, why can't they build a treatment system in 5 years? So it just something doesn't add up. And I think that there are so many internal problems at that old pulp mill that they know it wouldn't be feasible to meet the regulations that exist elsewhere in the country. This pulp mill still, the mill was designed to produce 500 metric tons per day. They're pushing close to 1,000. Yet they have the same boiler. And modifications that they've done to the pulp mill over the years weren't to improve the environmental performance. It was to improve production. So they've spent money internally at the mill over the years to boost production. And they're running the guts out of the place. So I just don't see a future for it. I think that there was a pulp and paper company in the U.S. that sent a price list of equipment that would be required to update this mill. It's close to $1 billion. So if they would spend the money on the mill and do the right thing, there could be a future. But why wouldn't they have done that within the 5 years that they had? If the entire Port Hawkesbury pulp mill could be built in a year, why can't they get their stuff together? Something is not adding up.
We've got Dave Gunning here with us. And as mentioned, Ellen Page was here in Nova Scotia. She went to the Alton gas site. She was in Pictou. Clearly, Dave, the focus is becoming laser concentrated on where things will go in the next several weeks, months, before the end of this year. Are you impressed? Are you unimpressed by the way the politicians have been handling this?
I have to say that I've been impressed. I think this is an extremely complicated file, and I think that the province, with Margaret Miller listing 19 weaknesses within the environmental assessment proposal that was put forward by Northern Pulp. I mean, she identified a lot of real concerns and weaknesses within their application that need to be addressed in order for them to move forward. They have a lot more homework to do, essentially. And I think that just because the government seems to be doing the right thing for the first time in the 50-year history of the mill. There's lots of things we can be upset about the government for, but it does appear that they are actually making positive steps right now to try to improve the situation. There's obviously a lot of pressure now being applied by the owners of the company to try to continue using Boat Harbor. But even if they could extend the use of Boat Harbor, they still need to renegotiate a contract with the union, and they still need a new industrial approval to move forward. Even if they get an extension, even if everything goes well for them, they still need another industrial approval to continue operating into the future. And they did not meet many of the terms and conditions that were outlined in their current industrial approval. So I don't know. It's like a comedy of errors, and yet they've got supporters, the union and forestry people, just kind of blindly supporting them. That they don't really know how bad things might be internally at the mill. But I mean, even some of the people working at the mill now they're coming to us saying, you guys are right about this. Yeah, we can't put that out there. We can't put the pipe out there. Yeah, it doesn't look like the mill's going to continue, but they told us our pensions are up to 80%, and, I'm okay with that, So there's all kinds of chatter coming from inside the mill now through the community, and it appears that a lot of the people at the pulp mill don't believe that the pulp mill is going to exist, that it won't, it just, they can't continue. There's just so many. Even if things go perfect for them, there are all these walls that they need to get over, and there's air emissions problems. There's internal equipment problems. There's black liquor spills. There's all kinds of problems. And so even if things go rosy for them, they still need to get over these walls.
Dave Gunning, we're out of time. Happy Earth Day. We're going to hear from Lil McPherson.
Yeah.
Lil McPherson's on the show a little later. I'll ask her if she knows anything more about the Ellen Page Project. Thank you, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks, Sheldon. Happy Easter, and yeah, we'll talk to you again.
Take care. That's Dave Gunning on the line with us from Pictou. Go to his website if you want to find out where he's playing and follow along. We're going to take a break, and Jeffrey Hossick is our guest. That's coming up in just a few moments, so we'll talk a little bit about his work helping first responders. We'll be back after this. It's Earth Day, the 22nd of April. Welcome back to the Sheldon McLeod Show here on News 95.7. Matt Brand is our producer. Our Twitter poll question of today: if you could only have one thing, would you pick a stadium or would you pick an art gallery? Looks like we're getting some response there, eh? And Matt Brand, I can never remember if we should... Am I supposed to tell people what's up there?
Tell them the percentage is not how many people voted. It sounds like more people vote if you don't tell them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So
we'll play. We might only have 3-4 voters, and it's like 75%. No. Just stick to the percentages.
56% say stadium. 44% art gallery.
Nicely done, Sheldon. That's
well, thank you. Appreciate that. And again, we're going to be chatting about presentations made to the Electoral Boundaries Commission. I know they made a report or brought back a report with recommendations. That was last week. Ross Haynes from Ames will tell us more. We're going to be joined by Mark Ferrant after 2 o'clock, C-417. We're talking about some legislation on the show this afternoon. This was a piece of legislation about supports for mental health for jurors. And I don't know if you're like me, but when I hear about a devastating attack, series of attacks like we heard from in Sri Lanka, and watching the coverage of it, how are people affected by what it is they see at their job? And moreover, here in Nova Scotia, many of the first responders that are likely to come into contact with you if there's an event could very well be volunteer. Not always, but a good chance of it. So when we're talking about what supports are there for volunteers, for professionals and others, that's the story behind the Firefighter Guy. And we have with us Jeffrey Hossick. He's known as the Firefighter Guy. He is a licensed psychotherapist, a veteran volunteer firefighter, search and rescue worker, and a former paramedic in Kentville. And Jeffrey, sounds like you have trouble keeping jobs. It's a joke. It's an
great
old joke.
Great to serve the community, I'll tell you.
It's an old joke, but I like it. So, Jeffrey, tell me a little bit about... I know I just kind of glossed over some of your resume there. So when did you start helping others?
Well, it's always been a passion of mine. I was trained as a pastor, and so I was always connected to communities and developing communities. And when I first became minister in the mid-80s, I volunteered as a paramedic, and wow, it's just a wonderful life.
You know, when I'm sure you see the same thing we see and that I see when I'm watching these devastating events that happen in the world, where, you know, many cases it's trying to make sense of what is for the most part senseless.
Oh, how true that is. And you know, people that we serve or people in our community are always in danger, and then we respond and put ourselves at risk with a physical and emotional injury with that too. But it's how we do it, right?
So, Jeffrey, how do you cope?
Well, I have a great community around me that really helps me to serve it. And I keep wrestling with the questions that we wrestle with. How do we do this? What goes on? How do I listen? How to be present? How do people be present with me? It's just a wonderful way to engage in the community. And we get respect for it, and we get help for it. But we need to be around each other as community. That's what I do. I'm a chaplain in the fire service, so I'm there for people who are there for people.
You know, we hear often, you know, this is Earth Day, and we talk about science and separating science from religion. Not necessarily that it's a requirement, but when we hear about how some things just don't seem compatible, what about psychotherapy and your faith?
Well, it works that we have to make meaning out of something, and so we always wrestle with it, and often we have an experience that really rattles what that's about. And so we have to sort of take some time and work that through and have someone come alongside of us and help us ask the questions. Not me to give the answer, but it's me to be a container for people while they are sort of healing and kind of figure it out for themselves.
Jeffrey Hossack is here. He's known as the firefighter guy. He's a licensed psychotherapist, as well as being a volunteer firefighter. So, Jeffrey, I'm sure in your path and your career as a paramedic and beyond that you've seen how events affect people differently. And some may appear to be, I won't say immune, but they show no outward effects of the some of the trauma they see. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, flashbacks are really just incomplete experiences from our past that haunt us. And so I sort of like to think of it like a lineup at a hospital emergency waiting room. All our issues are waiting to be healed. The problem is they're plugged in and they're zapping my energy, sort of like an appliance plugged into a wall outlet drawing current. It's okay as long as I can keep ahead of it, but there are times where it simply starts to become too overwhelmed and I end up really struggling with it.
Do you need to have a diagnosis for PTSD to get treatment?
Absolutely not. This is something that we do and wrestle with all the time. So any incident that we have, critical incident stress or post-trauma, or PTSD, they're all the same thing. It's just a matter of what severity it's going to. And so with a critical incident, which is what happens after an event, I have to take the time and sort of figure out what's going on. Also recognize that flashbacks, they really come to us in very specific ways. I like to think that there are three types of flashbacks that catch us by surprise, and it's the surprise that causes as much problem as the flashback itself.
Hmm. Can you give me an example?
Sure. The one type of flashback that we know as firefighters and paramedics is that what I call the ticking jack-in-the-box type one flashback. There are things that exist in the outside world. So if I cut someone out of a yellow car, I'm going to feel a little queasy around yellow cars or that particular stretch of highway where that accident occurred. And we all have those incidents or places or people where things have happened. I call it the ticking jack-in-the-box because the ticking means they're also time-stamped. So I had a friend of mine come by and she said, you know, I left that cheating husband of mine back in February and it's July. I'm falling apart. What's going on? Wow, that's a great question. Anything bad ever happening in July? And she said, no, nothing's bad ever happened. I said, any birthdays, anniversaries? And she got quiet. She said, well, I was married on the 15th of July. So that became a flashpoint for her. And she ended up with all the symptoms of critical incident stress because it reminded her of her cheating husband. A second type of flashback I call Pandora's box. And those are things that we got stored up over a period of time that opens up when we're vulnerable or overwhelmed. It just sort of opens up. And then all of a sudden, I'm thinking about things I never thought about for a long time. Why are they in my face? Because I'm vulnerable and overwhelmed. The third type of flashback I talk about is I talk about the black box, which is a dynamic flashback. When someone points their 10,000 PSI finger at me and I feel like a little kid, I'm flashing back. So one of the nature of a flashback is it's not that the memory comes to me here in 2019. I go back to the memory and it's the next moment in that event and I may feel like I'm 5 years old, but that's how the flashbacks work.
We've got Jeffrey Hossack here with us, and he's been helping firefighters deal with flashbacks. And so often when people are describing PTSD or critical incident stress, they talk about the triggers, and you've kind of given us some insight into that right now.
Mm-hmm.
What about the time invested and how to perhaps find a way to self-help as opposed to self-medicate?
That's a great question. We often want to avoid our triggers, so most of our energy is designed to get away from them as far as we can. I created a video series called The Way Out of Flashbacks. I've got it free, and it's on my website. But the issue around it is that actually leads us towards it so we can unplug those things that are drawing current from us. Normally, we just want to just keep on going, add more fuel to the generator, and try with adrenaline to just push past it. And sometimes we just have to stop and start to unplug things so we don't have to run quite so fast or quite so hard.
Again, chatting about the way out of flashbacks, dealing with post-traumatic stress, dealing with stressful incidents. Doesn't necessarily have to be as a firefighter or a paramedic or perhaps as a volunteer. I'm thinking you probably have cause to reach some of the people who are are bystanders. I often think at least our firefighters have a bit of opportunity when they get back to the station to debrief. Others just happen to experience what we experience and then keep on driving.
Oh, yeah. Strictly for me as a chaplain, I'm often connecting with the people who are actually, their house is burning down or their kids are in the car, or and it's really traumatic for them because this is so surprising for them. It's and oftentimes a flashback is so beyond our words that we can't even describe what's going on, which is why for me it's a passion to create something where someone can actually borrow my words for a time and actually find out what's going on. And then once they're able to do that, at least they don't get surprised when the flashback appears.
Hmm. Your goal is to keep people doing the work that they got involved with. Is there a time, is there a case, is there an individual, I'm not asking for names, but where sometimes it's just beyond and that there's perhaps no way forward in that career?
Sometimes that happens. If we wait too long and our adrenaline is too high, I like to describe it like a backdraft. We in the fire service know what a backdraft is. The heat is high, but there's just lacking air and the room is sealed. And as soon as that seal breaks, everything goes up all at the same time. And so oftentimes some of us have what I call walking PTSD. We're only running on the adrenaline and it's going to crack at some point. Any incident at all can just make the whole thing go up. And so sometimes people just need to stop. But the problem is, of course, for us firefighters, we don't want to stop. We want to keep going to the next call and the next call and the next call. And then we end up usually collapsing and taking others down with us.
Preservation of life. Sometimes it's our own. Jeffrey, the website.
Thank you.
Where's the website?
It's my website is my name, jeffreyhosick.com, Jeffrey with a J and an R-E-Y. The last name is Hosick. Ho is in what Santa says, sick as in not well. HOSICK.com.
Jeffrey Hosick. Thank you for doing this. And Jeff?
Thank you so much, Sheldon.
Maybe we'll get you in the studio at some time.
I love that. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Jeffrey Hosick is his name. Flashbacks. There was a story in the Herald that Paul Pickram did that caught my attention, and we reached out to Jeffrey Hosick, about what he does. All right. Let's talk politics, shall we? We just need more politicians. That would solve everything, wouldn't it? You think? Or maybe not. Ross Haynes, senior fellow at Ames. We're going to talk with him right after this. Well, last week there was a report released that says we should have 55 electoral districts in Nova Scotia, including the restoration of four protected districts aimed at improving representation for Black and Acadian voters. This independent commission came forward with its recommendations. Well, this was an opportunity last fall for our next guest to make a submission to that said commission. Ross Haynes is his name. He's a senior fellow with Ames, the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, and he's our guest on the program this afternoon. Mr. Haynes, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sheldon.
The presentation that you made to the Electoral Boundaries Commission, I don't see anything in here that suggests to you that you don't support having protected ridings for individual groups, including Black Nova Scotians or Acadian Nova Scotians. What was your main issue with the commission?
Well, first of all, we have to congratulate the commission doing what is really an impossible job and probably one that should be done effectively by our legislators instead of the commission, you know, sort of handing off the responsibility to a group of people and then giving them a set of guidelines that really constrains them from making any imaginative decision. They were constrained to making a decision of at least 51 seats, and they came in at 55. Now, I suppose our position was a bit of, given their guidelines, we were tilting at windmills. We at Ames and myself personally believe that the purpose of an electoral system is that everybody's vote should be equal. And this kind of twisting our electoral system to be something different, creating special interest group voting constituencies, is just plain wrong. And their way to deal with inequities in our society, whether it's racial or other community issues, is through government programs, not through twisting the ballot box by having all kinds of different voting numbers. And in the recommendation made by our current commission, we have seats with below 800 or 8,000 voters. There are several, four or five come to mind, that have between 8,000 and 6,000 voters. And then quite a number that'll have over 15,000 voters. So it's it creates a tremendous inequity in the number of people that any party or individual has to solicit to get elected to the legislature. So we twist the voting system in order to deal with social policy issues, which is just plain wrong. So our position was fewer seats. All the seats should have an equal number of electors as much as possible, and get away from this sort of political gerrymandering to try to deal with so-called inequities in our voting system.
We've got Ross Haynes as our guest on the program, senior fellow with Ames. He's a lawyer. He's a QC lawyer. He's someone who's presenting a case here that, as the report says, never have so few been governed by so many. We have a lot of politicians. We have we have a lot of elected representation.
We sure do, Sheldon. Pam Berman on CBC did an excellent study last January of 2018, where she sort of just looked at municipal governments, and we have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 to 400 elected municipal government officials, which are costing voters a tremendous amount of money. We have boards and commissions. We have our MLAs, 51 right now. And with the report of the Electoral Boundaries Commission, chaired by former St. Mary's President Colin Dodds, we'll have 55. So, you can't fault the commission for what they did. Their guidelines really prevented them from coming up with anything very imaginative. And so we're going to be stuck now with special interest group seats in Clare, Argyle, Richmond, and Preston. But the real damning part of this report and this whole scheme is some seats will have, I think, as few as, Argyle will have as few as 6,451 electors, and Halifax, Needham, 16,023, East Tants, 16,558, Lunenburg West, 16,000 plus, Sydney, Member 2, Timberley Prospect, Truro, all of those will have over 15,000, some over 16,000. So it's really an unfair result. And we can only blame our legislature for doing this because they hamstrung the Electoral Commission from making anything other than the kind of decision they've made.
If we don't use geographic boundaries, how are we to perhaps recognize that there are different interests in different parts of the province? Or should we just assume that those who are elected, say in some circles, in some municipalities, they used to have members elected at large, that they're going to get to the right issues and not just the ones with the money?
Well, it depends what you're trying to do with the electoral system. If every voter's vote should be pretty much equal, then we should divide up the province just on the basis of voting populations and stop trying to twist the voting system to do something else. Now, you can solve local problems with programs. The other thing that we're forgetting, too, is that our population is migrating to urban areas. We can't stop that. We have rapid electronic communications that allows people to be informed about issues regardless of where they are, where instantaneously. We're not in horse and buggy days or mail coming by a bicycle being, coming a few times a week. We have instant communication. So I don't think we really have these problems that the commission and the government wanted the commission to solve. Our voting system should be fair for every voter. Every citizen should be equal at the voting booth. Full stop.
And as you say, that all votes should be considered equal, but under first-past-the-post system, as we know, you can have false majorities, and that if you happen not to vote for the party in power, there's a pretty good chance your vote had zero value.
Well, that's part of the political process, though. You have to persuade people
to your first past the post position to win. I mean, we can continue to twist the system to other forms, you know, proportional representation, various models of one to the other. But really what we want to do is encourage people to get involved in public life through participating in politics. And winning and losing elections is all part of the political process. And compromise, the other thing that the first past the post system does is it promotes compromise. If you have special interest groups with minimal amounts of people that they need to get elected, you end up with intractable groups of people who will stick on a position because they have a group of people that will vote for them and then get into office, and they will be obstructionist and never compromise. And our system of government requires compromise, it requires imagination, and that's the way it works most effectively. And, you know, we've got a great system. We just have to stop trying to twist it around to do other things and then complain that it doesn't work. I mean, just get the system to work properly and stop having commissions come along and say, oh, well, you know, we're gonna give everybody special interest. The next thing we'll have, you know, voting by religious groups or voting by, well, I immigrated here from Manitoba and we should have a seat for Manitobans who come to Nova Scotia, or people who are second generation Canadians and not first, or immigrant populations. I mean, the ability to differentiate ourselves becomes mind-blowing in how nutty it can be. And if we start with racial groups and ethnic groups, it's the tip of a losing iceberg for us and for our democracy.
Ross Haynes, we will leave it at that for today. Clearly, this is a start of a conversation, a broader one. I look forward to our next conversation. Thank you, Ross.
Thanks so much, Sheldon. All the best.
Cheers. As he writes, a member of the Halifax Atlantic constituency, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, Ross Haynes. We'll take a break coming up after the 2 o'clock news. We're going to go back to this issue of Bill C-417, looking for supports for mental health for jurors, people who serve on rather troubling trials. We'll tell you more coming up after the news. That's next.